Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, February 26, 2015. Brace yourselves for a fear-filled media firestorm because we have learned the identity of so-called Jihadi John.
Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Hey, thank you, Jimmy Dean. Hold the sausage, will you? So, news has broken that the Washington Post, through multiple sources, has confirmed that British authorities have identified the man who has appeared in the grisly beheading propaganda videos from the Islamic State. Dubbed Jihadi John, he's got a British accent, and he's clearly a young man in his 20s. And we believe his given name is Mohammed Emwazi. And he's a British citizen, now age 26. And I want you to watch carefully and read carefully the news accounts that you will be hearing about Jihadi John and how he wound up where he is today. Because the New York Times story on this issue acknowledges that Emwazi apparently was set on the path to radicalization after being detained by the authorities on a visit to Tanzania in 2009 for a safari after he graduated from college. He was accused by British intelligence officers of trying to make his way to Somalia. Now, I'll give the Times credit because they went to the trouble of contacting Asim Qureshi, research director at CAGE. And CAGE is the British charity that used to be called CAGE Prisoners. It was formed by Moazzam Begg and others who are alumni of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And it turns out that Emwazi was in touch with CAGE over the period of several years. And I'm going to link to the account that is on the CAGE website. It's detailed, lengthy, and I invite you to read it, because it will open your eyes. We're going to hear very limited talk about the police state activities that radicalized this man and turned him into at least a front man for the brutality of the Islamic State. So you heard that after college graduation, he and a buddy bought tickets, flew to Tanzania for a safari. But when he got there, based on apparently a hold that was ordered by the British government, authorities there held him, and they had been instructed just to put him on the next flight back to London. And he, of course, said, "What the hell's going on here?" And this produced a saga, and I won't take you through every step of it. But he is his family heritage is from Kuwait. And based on tradition, Mohammed had an arranged marriage set up. He went to Kuwait to meet his bride. He spent 8 months there, had a contract working for a well-known computer programming company. And then he decided to return to London to visit his family. And this began this nightmare for Mohammed, because he was apparently on a no-fly list. And he went through all kinds of channels trying to get an explanation from the British government about why he was a suspect. And he was told, "We don't believe you're going to Tanzania. We think you were really trying to get to Somalia." And perhaps that's the case. But from Mohammed's side of the story, that appears to be flatly untrue. So he went through one round after another and finally felt that he was a prisoner in Britain, because when he tried to fly to Kuwait, and I don't know all these details, but apparently the first arranged marriage fizzled. I don't think they actually got married. And then there was a second bride that he was attempting to visit. But the authorities would not permit it. So, a series of communications, I'm reading now, in person and via email with CAGE Research Director Asim Qureshi, reveals the anxiety felt by Mohammed due to his banning from Kuwait. Aware of the wider issues being faced in the war on terror, he still made a plea for assistance from CAGE in any way that we could. So, CAGE attempted to help him sort through the British government bureaucracy, and it obviously was not successful. And some of the details are recounted in this lengthy blog post. What it boils down to is that this man was radicalized because, from all accounts, he was completely innocent of even any intent or interest in terrorist groups. But because he became a suspect, and it's clear his phone calls were monitored, he was surveilled heavily before he even made the trip to Tanzania. And so he is clearly a product of these misguided efforts. This idea that by creating police states around the globe, that we can predict and prevent criminal activity from taking place. And there's an attempt to do that in the United States. I'll get to that in a few minutes here. So in 2012, the frustration was building. So in desperation, Mohammed tried to legally change his name to see if that would be a way around the ban on his travel to Kuwait and in general to the Middle East. Now, in some of these emails that he exchanged with CAGE, he indicated that part of his growing radicalization was what he knew about America's treatment of Muslims, about Guantanamo, about Abu Ghraib, about the imprisonment here in the United States of a well-known, what many people consider to be a political prisoner named Siddiqui. And so we have to look at this, and when you see Mohammed Emwazi depicted as a, you know, movement Muslim extremist, understand that all of this originated when an apparently innocent man was treated not just as a suspect, but as a proven criminal. And so the CAGE article here concludes, this proves that Mohammed and his friends were stopped in Tanzania under a false pretense, and incidentally that British intelligence agents played a massive role in his ordeal. His holiday was ruined not because of Tanzanian passport control officers, but it seems that he and his friends were stopped on the orders of British intelligence agents, as they even took advantage of this time to make their presence known to his family. And that's the other creepy parts of this are, at one point they told him that they'd already talked to his wife in Kuwait, or his bride-to-be, and they repeatedly visited his parents. And so because of his frustration and distress, oh, and I forgot to mention one other thing. Along the way here, British intelligence tried to flip him into becoming an asset of MI5. So when you see the arrogance, when you see this kind of government omniscience, where they believe they know the intentions of an individual through wiretaps and other surveillance programs, well, this shows just how far off the rails we have gone. And I hope you will read the piece at CAGE, and I hope that you will look critically at any coverage that you see about Mohammed Emwazi. On to another revelation of massive surveillance attempts. And this, I believe, is the story that we have been tipped off was about to drop in the recent past. And I need to credit one of my staunch listeners and contributors, a subscriber from Switzerland, Olivier de Merlot, who emails me frequently with leads and tips. And also, yesterday I mentioned that I noticed that he has two different annual subscriptions. And when I thanked him for tipping me off yesterday about this article I'm about to tell you about, he confirmed that it is his intention to have two annual subscriptions to this podcast. And Olivier, I am deeply grateful for your support and for tipping me off about this article. And that'll be my mention about subscribers today, so take the hint. If you're not a subscriber, you want to support my work, come on over to peterbcollins.com and follow the link that says sign up. So, Dateline Cancun, Mexico. This article appears on a website called Ars Technica, and it is highly technical. It's written for computer experts and geeks, and I don't count myself among them. But it's fascinating, and it exposes a group of hackers called the Equation Group. And this is not to spoil any suspense, but all of the trails toward the Equation Group lead to America's NSA. So researchers with the Kaspersky Lab, and let's be fair, that is based in Moscow, Russia, they have been studying the distribution of malware around the world. And they have documented 500 infections by what they call Equation Group in at least 42 countries, led by Iran, Russia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, Syria, and Mali. And because of the self-destruct mechanism built into the malware, the researchers suspect that this is just a tiny percentage of the total. Now, the capabilities of this malware scheme network, going back at least to 2002, are pretty impressive. They have malware that enables the use of virtual file systems, a feature also found in the highly sophisticated Regan malware, and Ed Snowden documents indicate that the NSA used Regan to infect the partly state-owned Belgian firm Belgicom. That's the one where they presumably have compromised the SIM cards that go into billions of cell phones around the world. Another capability, the stashing of malicious files in multiple branches of an infected computer, and by encrypting all malicious files and storing them in multiple branches, the infection was impossible to detect using antivirus software. Isn't that nice? It has redirects that sent iPhone users to unique exploit web pages, and then infected machines reporting to Equation Group Command identified themselves as Macs, an indication that the group successfully compromised both iOS, that's the software for phones and iPads, and also OS X devices, which are, you know, laptops and desktop computers. In addition, the malware system enables the use of more than 300 or involves the use of more than 300 internet domains and 100 servers. U.S. stick-based reconnaissance malware is used to map air-gapped networks. Now, if you don't know what that means, air-gapped are networks that are not connected to the internet for security reasons. And when we developed the Stuxnet virus, apparently in collaboration with Israel, and a similar software called Flame, well, those softwares, those viruses, have the ability to jump to bridge air gaps. I don't know how they do it, but that's pretty pretty amazing. And they also have a novel way of bypassing code signing restrictions in Windows, and this allows them to achieve kernel-level code execution. And I'll be candid, I don't know what the hell that means. But what these researchers say is that while they can't 100% say that this is the handiwork of the NSA, that their detailed evidence strongly implicates the NSA. And there are several reasons that they quote. I'll just give you one. and that is that a highly advanced keylogger in the Equation Group malware library calls itself Grok. And based on information from Ed Snowden, we have learned that Grok is a part of the NSA suite of malware. So this is a fascinating story, and there's more to it here that I won't go into on the podcast, but I encourage you to read this. And Olivier, I thank you for locating that and sharing it with us. And now that we know who's distributing massive amounts of malware into our computers, let's celebrate that the FCC, in a 3-2 vote today, approved regulation of the Internet under Title II of the Communications Act, which essentially preserves net neutrality. This is a major victory for activists and the left in this country, and I'm pleased to see it. We saw this developing when Tom Wheeler, the former cable and wireless industry lobbyist, who's bizarrely Obama's chair of the FCC, tipped that he was responding to the request from the White House to adopt this policy. And so we've got a lot of blowback from Republicans. They are all worked up over this. They say it ain't broke, so you don't need to fix it. But, of course, they're doing the bidding of their corporate sponsors who want a tiered service internet because they'll be able to dominate it. And while we're told that this adoption of Title II is not going to lead to rate regulation, I say that wouldn't be a bad idea. We also need the FCC to force the industry, which is comprised of a group of monopolies and duopolies, to invest in improving our broadband networks to increase network speeds. And that doesn't appear to be on anybody's agenda except for me. Yesterday we told you, and you've probably seen corporate media coverage, of the trumpeted arrest of three individuals, two from Brooklyn, one who was in Florida, and they're accused of getting ready to travel to Syria to fight for the Islamic State. And as I told you, it was in paragraph 17 of the New York Times account of this that they acknowledged the presence of a paid FBI informant. And to his credit, Glenn Greenwald and Greenwald's associate Murtaza Hussein at The Intercept have blown the lid off another frame-up by the FBI. And I encourage you to read this. I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast. But it echoes what I told you yesterday, that virtually every one of these cases includes a paid informant who provides the plans and the money for them to pull off the plans that were suggested by the FBI provocateur. And in this case, once again, these people had they simply didn't have the money to travel to the Middle East to join the Islamic State, and the fact that they were headed to the airport, well, it was facilitated by their FBI informant. So they not only create the crime, but they fund it, and then when these guys follow that path, they bust them and tell the rest of us they have protected us from another terrorist plot. And Greenwald writes, "We're constantly bombarded with dire warnings about the grave threat of homegrown terrorists, lone wolf extremists, and ISIS. So intensified are these official warnings that the New York Times earlier this month cited anonymous U.S. intelligence officials to warn of the growing ISIS threat and announce the prospect of a new global war on terror." But Greenwald asks, "How serious of a threat can all of this be, at least domestically, if the FBI continually has to resort to manufacturing its own plots by trolling the Internet in search of young drifters and or the mentally ill, whom they target, recruit, and then manipulate into joining? Does that not by itself demonstrate how overhyped and insubstantial this threat actually is? Shouldn't there be actual plots, ones that are created and fueled without the help of the FBI, that the agency should devote its massive resources to stopping?" Well put. A little earlier, I talked about these efforts to predict criminal behavior. The Associated Press reports that several states are trying to reduce prison populations with secretive new psychological assessments to predict which inmates will commit future crimes and who might safe to be released. Who might be safe to be released, pardon me. And this I find really frightening. Because like that bad Tom Cruise movie, Majority Report, where they had those people floating in saline solution and, you know, when they had a feeling, Tom Cruise would go and bust some guy before he could commit a crime. Well, these programs use questionnaires where they ask an offender about education, family, income, job status, their history, parents' arrest. And, you know, certainly that information can be useful. And certainly in evaluating the fitness of paroling or releasing prisoners, I don't have a problem with a psychological evaluation and looking at their history. But if that becomes the basis for whether or not they are released, then we've moved into a godlike zone that I, for one, am highly uncomfortable with. And here's a fascinating report from California Today. A new study shows that those who were convicted under our ridiculous and draconian three strikes law, but who have been freed before the end of those long sentences after voters reformed the law in 2012, their reoffending is occurring at a historically low level, under 5%, when the average across the prison population in California is that about 45 to 70% will be back in prison. 45 of them commit new crimes, the rest end up violating parole and wind up with an extended sentence. And so I would argue that the efforts to predict whether these three-strike prisoners would reoffend would have said, well, we can't take the risk of releasing these people. And the facts show that as a group, they do not pose a significant risk to public safety here in California. Today, over at Boiling Frogs Post, we released our latest Processing Distortion podcast, an in-depth interview with Harper's reporter Michael Ames. And his story in the February issue takes a look at how private prisons and other profiteers, along with some politicians who think they benefit from being tough on crime, are preventing prison reform. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
Corrections Corporation of America, CCA, and GEO basically run a dual monopoly, a duopoly over this industry, MTC being, I think if you count MTC, those three companies run about 90% mm-hmm. of the private prison beds in the country, and GEO and CCA run 75%.
And excuse me, but what happened to Wackenhut? Did it get absorbed by CCA or GEO? Because it used to be a player.
Wackenhut became, I don't want to be misquoting here, Wackenhut evolved into CCA.
Okay. I think you're right about that.
Yeah, I'd have to check that, but mm-hmm. it was a name change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when we talk about private prisons, there is a tendency to, as one of my sources in the story put it, to sort of fetishize the private prison problem as if it is the driving problem, and I think that's a misdirection. I think that's getting lost in the forest, getting lost in the trees and losing sight of the forest, which is that there are incentives for the government here that outstrip even those profit motives. The government needs private prisons in order to house an overabundance of prisoners. Private prisons existed hundreds of years ago in America when the British needed places to put their debtors and prisoners in this country. So the private prisons have become a symptom, but they also are a need. And I think of these companies, while they are profiting incredibly for their shareholders and their executives, they're also, it's hard to even separate them out from the government itself. They are somewhat, I think of them as extensions of government policy.
You can hear the full interview with journalist Michael Ames about his Harper's story. It's available over at boilingfrogspost.com. Just click on the podcast tab and then select Processing Distortion. Iran has been staging some bizarre war games, and we do this all the time. You know, we set up war games all over the globe with some of our allies. But in Iran, they televised this event, and they created a mock U.S. aircraft carrier They floated it out near the Straits of Hormuz, which is the choke point of entry to the Persian Gulf. And they've been busy attacking it with fighter jets and surface attacks from the water. And I think I understand why they're doing this. This is entirely for domestic consumption. They're trying to show that by reaching a nuclear control deal with the U.S. and the other five nations, that they are not turning into passive patsies. And I think that this is a really interesting development because I think it shows that Iran is committed to the agreement that's being negotiated, and they are busy trying to keep the opponents of this kind of a deal from gaining too much ground in domestic politics there. Meanwhile, that negotiation, of course, is the focus of the bizarre warmonger Benjamin Netanyahu, who is just about to pack his bags and finish writing his speech that he'll deliver to a joint session of Congress on Tuesday. And the exchange of verbal barbs between the U.S. and Israel continues to grow. Yesterday it was John Kerry testifying on Capitol Hill, and he was pretty blunt for a guy who, you know, pretends to be a diplomat. He said regarding Netanyahu and his efforts to scuttle this negotiation, he said he may have a judgment that is just not may be correct here. And then he added, the prime minister, as you will recall, was profoundly forward-leaning and outspoken about the importance of invading Iraq under George W. Bush. And we all know what happened with that decision. Well, you voted for it, Johnny. Let's not forget that. At any rate, I think it's very interesting to see people like Susan Rice telling Charlie Rose that Netanyahu's decision to come and give this speech just a few weeks before his re-election has injected a degree of partisanship, which is not only unfortunate, says Rice, but I think it's destructive of the fabric of the relationship. And we have a number of Democrats who have said that they will not be attending the Netanyahu speech. And people like Vice President Biden and John Kerry are leaving the country. So they have an excuse about why they won't be there. And just a few hours ago, the White House announced, and I'm a little surprised at this, that Susan Rice and Samantha Power have agreed to speak to the AIPAC conference, which is also a spot where Netanyahu will appear to stoke the Zionist embers here in the United States. And I really hoped that the White House would completely boycott AIPAC, but it shows the power of the Zionist lobby in Washington and its control of both political parties. And finally today, I've got a couple of stories from California I want to share with you. We have a very conservative archbishop in the liberal city of San Francisco. His name is Salvatore Cordiglione, and he's been in the job for, I think, about 3 years now. And it's important to note that he is a Ratzinger appointment. Pope Benedict parked Cordiglione here in San Francisco, knowing that he was a conservative. And I think what Cordiglione is doing now points up the difference between those who were appointed by Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger, and those who have been appointed by Pope Francis, Benedict's successor. Because Cordiglione has been publicly vowing to impose morals clauses into the collective bargaining agreements of teachers who work at Catholic high schools in this archdiocese. And the clause will prevent them from marching in a pro-choice parade, marching in a pro-gay marriage or marriage equality parade, and other public expressions that conflict with church teachings. They're also saying that you cannot cohabitate with a person of the same sex or the opposite sex. And it's a really intrusive effort to control the lives of the people who teach. Now, it would be one thing if the archbishop was trying to impose some discipline and standards on members of religious orders, because they offer up a vow of obedience. But a high school math or English teacher is not a part of the religious ministry of the Catholic Church, but that's what Cordiglione tried to do. He wanted to refer to all teachers as ministers. Now, this invokes the precedent from a recent Supreme Court ruling, where they said that anyone designated as a minister who works for a religious organization is beyond the reach of America's discrimination laws and other workplace rules. So the teachers are fighting mad. Even students and parents are worked up about this. And so the Archbishop is trying to smooth this out without actually making any significant changes. So he went to the editorial board of the local paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, and he made pleasant noises about how he loves gays and gay students are fine at his high schools and blah, 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 but that it's his duty to stand up against evil behavior. And so he said that he would strike the part about ministers from the contract and the teacher handbook. But shortly after he left the Chronicle, a spokesman essentially clarified and walked back most of his comments, saying that, well, we might change minister to ministry. And so this is a slippery guy who is using heavenly deception, dishonesty, dissembling, lies, you choose the word, to try to soft pedal the hard line moves that he is attempting to make. And this is so far out of step of the mainstream secular society here in California that we wonder if the Archbishop has had any contact with the new Pope. And does he get the message that he's supposed to move on from the church's obsession with sexual issues and work on poverty, injustice, and other humanitarian causes? And lastly today, the stench of Arnold Schwarzenegger's reign in Sacramento is still palpable. Last week, the state of California made a settlement with investors and had to fork over $24 million in order to cancel a boneheaded deal that Schwarzenegger put in play when he was desperate for cash because Grover Norquist and his allies wouldn't allow any tax increases while California was in the dumper. We were running red ink budgets for 3 or 4 years. And so desperate for cash like a drug addict or somebody heading for a pawn shop, Arnold Schwarzenegger agreed to sell a bunch of California state buildings for $1.2 billion. Only the payback in order to raise that money was $1.4 billion over a 35-year period. That's due to interest and escalating lease payments. And so this is, you know, he famously ripped up the state's credit cards at one point. And this guy was just such a phony blowhard that I think we ought to send the bill to him. He's got $24 million from his latest bad action movie, or maybe a string of them. And, you know, if he doesn't have to pay off the housekeeper who he impregnated while he was also fathering a child with Maria Shriver. I mean, the babies were born within a couple of weeks of each other. Schwarzenegger left a real ugly legacy here. And sadly, Jerry Brown has had to clean it up. And that's just the latest cost. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everyone. And I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until